Philippians chapter 1, starting in the second half of verse 18 through verse 23. Yes, and I will rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance. As it is, my eager expectation and hope that I will not be ashamed, not at all be ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet, which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and to be with Christ, for that is far better.
So we've been talking about suffering for a few weeks now, and some things that we've learned along the way, or we realize that the Christian actually suffers differently and views suffering much differently than the world. We've learned that. We've learned that the Bible calls us to a certain way of suffering, and that all of Philippians really is a call to maturity. That the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Paul, or God through the Apostle Paul, is wanting to teach us as well that we're to grow in our understanding and love of God. We're to grow in our faith, and one aspect of that is how we view suffering and how we respond to suffering as well. And so we're called to certain things when it comes to suffering. We're called to view it in a certain way, and we're called to respond in a certain way. Now, here's what we've talked about so far as we've dealt with this little mini-series of suffering. One is that suffering and evangelism actually go together, right? That the advancement of the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ, actually presses forward in the midst of suffering more so than it does in the midst of prosperity. That you being awesome and your marriage being awesome and you having a lot of cash and then telling people about Jesus doesn't actually make that much of Jesus. Right? It makes much of what, you know, maybe Jesus' stuff, but it doesn't lift high the name of Jesus as much as if your life was a wreck, right? Your life, your marriage was a mess. And you were suffering and you lost all things, but you still said, Jesus is enough. That lifts high the name of Jesus. That's going to have an effect on people when you tell them about Jesus. Hey, how you doing, man? Horrible, actually. But Jesus is awesome still. But Jesus is good still. That's going to actually give you some ears to speak to. And so suffering and evangelism, they actually go together, right? They go together. The second thing we talked about is that suffering and joy go together. Right? Paradox Church, that's what we call that. It's a paradox. Suffering and joy go together. That we are, as Christians, to be sorrowful yet always rejoicing. That we can be sad and we can be walking through difficult times, but we still rejoice. There's still a joy to us. Not that we don't grieve, not that we have that kind of fake face on and we kind of give those Christian platitudes and we act like everything is fine when not everything's fine. That's not what I'm talking about. I mean, in the midst of your sadness, there's a deep abiding joy. That in the midst of your suffering, you can still rejoice because our joy is actually bound up in Jesus. And no matter what we suffer, no matter what we lose, it doesn't take our joy. It doesn't take joy. It doesn't take Jesus away. And so it doesn't take our joy. And so we can rejoice then as God's people, even in the midst of suffering. This week, we're going to talk about suffering and Jesus, more precisely how suffering helps us to know and see Jesus better. Suffering and Christ is what we're going to look at this morning. Now, here's the question that I want to ask you as we go into our one verse that we're going to look at. Here's kind of a question I want you to think about and answer as we begin to walk through this one verse, this text. Here it is. What does your life orient around? What does your life revolve around? When you look at your life, you take an honest look at your heart and you wonder and you look and you say, what is everything about my life working towards? right? What's the black hole of your life where everything gets swallowed up in it? Everything you do gets swallowed up. It's the gravity of your life, right? It's pulling everything towards itself. And so all that you do, whether you're working or at school or in relationships or money or time, anything that you do, it's actually centered on this one thing. What is that? What is your life orient around? Because our text, it's going to call us to orient our life around Jesus. Right, to live this Christ-centered life, to where everything about us is centered on Jesus. And suffering, it's going to reveal what it is that our life is centered on. Suffering will reveal what your life orients around, what it's centered, what it revolves around. And the text is going to say we need to have a Christ-centered life. Jesus needs to be the gravity of our life. And so that's what we'll look at, as suffering reveals those things to us. Now, I want to focus our attention just on one verse, verse 21, right? To live is Christ and to die is gain. And I want to try to keep it as simple as possible. I just want to do two things. One, what does this verse mean? Right? What does it mean? What does it mean to live is Christ and to die is gain? And then second, how does suffering make this verse, how does suffering make this text, this truth, to live is Christ, to die is gain, a reality in our heart that it fills us with joy, a joy unspeakable and unbreakable? How does suffering actually make this verse a part of your life? That's what I want to talk about, okay? So what does it mean? And then how does suffering actually take this verse and stamp it to our bones and put it deep in our heart? That's what I want to know, okay? So, verse 21, to live is Christ, to die is gain. Here's what's really interesting to me. If you had been part of the Philippian church and this was being read to you, when you got to verse 21 and it was read to you, it would have been stunning to hear. Absolutely stunning to hear. So all the way, in the beginning of the letter, like until now, they had been hearing, the early church, the Philippian church had been hearing, and we've heard as well, right, through the Holy Spirit, that this letter is for us as well, these wonderful things, that you're a saint, like your identity is that you're a saint, right? They heard that, we heard that. That God, he's going to finish what he started in you. He's already said that in the letter, right? And that we're called to mature in this love, and we're to grow up abounding all the more in this love that has an experiential knowledge of the love of God for us, that we might love God and we might love others, that's what he wants us to mature in. He's talked to us about how suffering has actually advanced the cause of the gospel, and we can rejoice in suffering. All of that actually is just building to verse 21. The whole first part of the letter builds to verse 21. It kind of crescendos to verse 21. And this is the apex of what he's trying to say in the first part of the letter. And he'll begin to prove it, in a sense, or show what it means to live as Christ and to die as gain as he goes forward in the letter. And so you can imagine then that as this church had gathered, this would be an unbelievable moment. So just think about it, right? You had a Lydia. Remember Lydia? She was the Asian rich woman who had the clothing line, right? She was the first member of this church. And then you had the slave girl. Remember Paul helped deliver her out of oppression and slavery. And so she's a part of this church. The Philippian jailer is a part of this church. When Paul and Silas were in jail, and he ended up becoming a Christian, because that's what happens when angels blow up in your doors, right? And there's a couple of people named in Philippians, Eudia and Syntyche. They would be in this church. They're fighting. We'll learn about their fight in Philippians 4. And then Epaphroditus, he was actually the guy that they sent to Paul. And then Paul sent this letter back to them. So they're all in this church, right? If you can just imagine, they're in this church, and they're probably at Lydia's house, okay? So the early church would meet in one of the richer, wealthier members' homes, because it was bigger, and that's where they would meet on a Sunday, and they would gather there. And so you can just kind of imagine, they're gathering for church on a Sunday at Lydia's house. and maybe they're standing in the courtyard, or maybe there's a room big enough for them to sit in, and they're kind of gathered about, and they're greeting one another. Maybe they're greeting one another with a holy kiss, right? We talked about that a few weeks ago, and then they're welcoming new guests and some of the friends that were coming into their church for the first time and wanted to know where the bathroom was and you know what's going to happen here and who's this Jesus guy and all of that. And then you can imagine like the buzz that would be going around the room because they had heard that the Apostle Paul had sent a letter and that it's going to be read today. I mean, that's a big deal, right? Nobody was missing church that Sunday, right? The Bible's being written and they're getting a letter from the Apostle Paul. They're nobody's missing church that day. And so there's kind of this buzz around Lydia's house and room, and then everything starts to get settled down, and maybe they sing a hymn or two, right? Probably two, because we sing two, and that's biblical. So, you know, you do two first, and then, you know, the sermon, and then they did three probably after, because that's the right way to do church, and so they sing a hymn or two, right? And then what would happen is a pastor, an elder, would stand up, and he would have the letter, right? He would have the letter. And this is the letter from the Apostle Paul. And he begins to read the letter, begins to read all the wonderful things that he's already read to us. And then he gets to verse 21, and it would have been stunning. It would have been stunning. In the original language, verse 21 has no verbs. It has no verbs. It's just this alliteration. It's this tone to it, this rhythm to it, this poetry to verse 21 that was beautiful. And it was powerful, too. It doesn't translate well in the English, but basically they heard this. It's not going to be nearly the same, but basically this is what they heard because there's no verbs, right? So this is what they heard. To live, Christ. To die, gain. Right? Everything building up to this point, and they hear, to live, Christ. To die, gain. This kind of triumphant declaration from their brother Paul, who's suffering, right? He's in prison, he's in chains, he's suffering, he's going. They sent Epaphroditus there to help comfort him, to see how he was doing and to give him some money. So they're wondering how he is, how is brother Paul doing? And so they get to this part of the letter and they hear this kind of triumphant declaration that to live is Christ, to die is gain. That had to be comforting to their heart. It had to send their heart soaring, actually. Have you ever been around, and I think I asked this question in the first week as we talked about suffering, but I think it's worth it again because that's what's happening here. Have you ever been around a mature Christian who was suffering? And they suffered so well. Like there was a joy to them and an inner strength to them that was just profound, right? They actually really trusted Jesus. They didn't just, you know, everything happens for a reason. It wasn't that, right? It was they literally, actually, death grip hold on Jesus. And there was a joy to them and a strength to them. Have you ever been around a Christian like that who was suffering? That's what this was like, man. They knew they loved the Apostle Paul. Remember, they're partners in the gospel, and he's got deep affection. This is a wonderful relationship between this church and the Apostle Paul. And they want to know how he's doing. And he says, man, to live is Christ. And to die is gain. He's doing well, right? He's doing well. He's strong in the midst of this, and the Lord is producing in him a great joy in the midst of their suffering. And so this is a big deal for them to have heard this. It was a stunning, powerful verse to have been read. To live, Christ. To die, gain. It's powerful. Now, what does it mean? What does it mean? To live is Christ. He's saying life means Christ for me. He's saying life for me is Jesus. My life revolves around Jesus. It's centered on Jesus. It's orientated around Jesus. Jesus is the black hole of my life. It swallows up everything else. Everything else feeds my laser-focused pursuit of more Jesus. That's what he means. Jesus gives Paul meaning and inspiration and purpose in everything that he does. He says in Galatians 2:20, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. That was his fuel. The love of Jesus and the sacrifice of Jesus was his fuel for life. He loved me and gave himself up for me. And so that was everything for him. To live is Christ. To die is gain. This was everything to Paul. And then he explains in verse 22 a little bit about what he means. He says in verse 22, if I am to live, so to live is Christ, here's what that means. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. So man, if I do live, that's great. I will do some more work for Jesus. Like, this is great. More of my life will be centered on Jesus. More of my life will revolve around Jesus. Everything about Paul in his life was Jesus. To live is Christ. My life means Christ. Now, when he says to live is Christ, it's not a triumphant declaration that's trouble-free. It's not like everything's going to be awesome now. That's not what he's saying, right? He's not saying, you know, Paul, you guys, you doing all right? Yeah, man, no big deal. To live is Christ, you know? To live is Christ. What does that mean? Nothing. No, he's not saying this is going to be a carefree, trouble-free, suffering-free life to live as Christ. He's saying when suffering comes, to live is Christ. When I'm sad, to live is Christ. When there's a trial, to live is Christ, especially during affliction, especially when there's pain, my life centers around Jesus. That's what he means. To live is Christ. And so then the obvious question then is, what would your life say? Right? To live is Christ, or to live is something else? To live is pleasure. To live is comfort. To live is control. To live is my performance. If you were to look at your life, what would it say? Here's just the truth for many of us. Jesus, or our faith, or Christianity, it's one slice of our pie, right? So the pie of our life, Jesus becomes one slice of that pie, an important slice, but a slice nonetheless. And then we have other slices, right? And so we have Jesus, or our faith, or Christianity, and then we have work, and we've got hobbies, and we've got, you know, family, and we've got school, and we got other slices to the pie. And maybe Jesus or our faith is the biggest slice of the pie, right? He's the biggest slice of the pie, but he's not the whole pie. For many of us, that's our life. And the Bible's saying, no, Jesus is the whole pie. Like, Jesus is the whole pie. Everything gets swallowed up in Jesus. Work and time and money and friends and family and school, all of that gets swallowed up in Jesus, and all of it should orient or revolve around Jesus. That's what the Bible is calling us to. To live is Christ. And then to die is gain. Well, what does that mean? What does that mean? Now, this isn't a death wish that Paul has, like some would say. Some would say, you know, to die is gain. He wants to die. That's what Paul is saying. And they would look at the second part of verse 22. They would see that, yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. And they would say, well, maybe Paul was contemplating suicide. Maybe he had some sort of power or choice in the matter in his imprisonment, to where if he did this, he would live, and if he did this, he would die. And maybe he's wondering which one he should choose. That's not what this means necessarily. That's not what's happening. He's not going to choose death. He's basically saying what he says in 2 Corinthians 5:8, that to be away from the body is to be home with the Lord. He's basically just acknowledging that to be away from the body, to be dead, is to be nearer, to be more fully with Jesus. And that's far better, he says. That's far better. So death then becomes gain. How is that possible? Do you realize? I mean, death, and we don't really think much about death, but certainly we can imagine death not being awesome. But have you thought deeper about it? Like, death means the loss of everything. Literally, the loss of everything. The relationships that you love, the friendships that you have, the family that you've served and that have served you. I mean, that's gone. Right? Gone. All the things of the world that have brought you pleasure and comfort, that you enjoy, all the things in the world that you're pursuing, all the things in the world that you want more of, gone. Everything in this world, gone when you die. And that's gain? Let's not so easily accept that. And that's gain? Do we really believe that? Look at verse 23. He'll say, I am hard-pressed between the two, death or life, right? I am hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and to be with Christ, for that is far better. So death is gain. Why? Because it's far better to be with Christ. Really? Really? Do you believe that? This is not some altruistic, holy talk from the Apostle Paul. This is him actually saying, I would gain more of Jesus. That's far better. That's far better. Right? This isn't like sacrifice. I mean, we just got to sacrifice for Jesus. We just got to serve Jesus. No, this is a hedonistic pleasure pursuit, a joy pursuit of Paul that says, actually, death would be better because I'd have Jesus. And that's far better. It's far better than anything that life can provide. He'll say in Philippians 3:8 later on in the letter, I have suffered the loss of all things. I count them as rubbish. I can't wait to get to that word, by the way. It's a very, very good word. Okay, in the Bible, it's a great word, okay? In order, here's why he counts everything as loss, in order that I may gain Christ. This is all gain for him. Like, this is a plus for him. This is what he wants. He wants, this is a pursuit of pleasure and joy, and this is better. Death is gain. Death is gain. Yes, because for the Christian, if we lose everything but gain Christ, we've lost nothing and have it all. Let me say it again. For the Christian, if we lose everything but gain Christ, we've lost nothing and have it all. For what does it profit a man who would gain the whole world but lose his soul? And I would also say, what is lost if he loses everything but still has Jesus? And so to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Of course, these two statements go together, right? So if death is not gain for you, then you're surely not living for Christ. Like, to live is not Christ for you either, then. Not in the way that it would mean. But this is the maturity, the spiritual growth that God is calling us to. This is part of it. Right? To be able to say to live is Christ and to die is gain. That's where he has you. It's not, Christian maturity is not, you know, you're obeying all the rules. No, it's you're loving the right things. You're trusting in the right things. To live is Christ, to die is gain would be your heart's cry. Paul will say in Romans 14:8, for if we live to the Lord, and if we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. Now, do you realize to live as Christ, to die as gain, is ultimate freedom? Like, do you realize what this life means? Like, this is fully life. To live is Christ, to die is gain. Like, do you know what Paul is basically saying? He's like, if they let me live, cool, to live is Christ. If they kill me, no big deal. To die is gain. It doesn't matter what they do to Paul in prison. Right? You can't beat a guy like that. If he's like, well, we're going to let you live. Well, to live is Christ. Well, we're going to kill you. To die is gain. I mean, what do? You can't do anything. He's going to win. That's freedom. Do you understand that? Like, that's freedom. That's ultimate freedom where nobody can take anything from you. This is where risk-taking and boldness comes from. Not from you believing in yourself. It's not from you believing in yourself. Risk-taking and boldness comes from Jesus, from your life centered on Jesus, where you have nothing to lose because you can't lose Jesus. That's where risk-taking and boldness come from. This is where fearlessness comes from. That the more your life is centered on Jesus, the more you're fearless. I mean, to live is Christ, to die is gain. This is the life that you are after. To live is Christ, to die is gain. This is the joy that's unspeakable and unbreakable because it can't be taken from you. And it's unspeakable because it's found in an infinite, an eternal, and inexhaustible God. When your joy is found in God, it just keeps growing. And so this is the life that we're after. Now, let's just be honest with one another, which I know is hard because it's church, right? You're not supposed to be honest at church. You're supposed to put on this, you know, Jesus wants your best, right? We don't believe that. I'm just saying that So let's be honest, okay? Let's be honest with each other. We're not here yet. If we're just honest with ourselves, the majority of us have just not reached this level of maturity, right? To be able to say to live is Christ and to die is gain. Like if we're just being honest with ourselves, we're not here yet. And that's okay. Like that's why the letter is being written to you. That's why God is calling you to maturity. That's what we're to grow up into, to be able to say to live is Christ and to die is gain. But here's the thing. Some of us don't even have a category for this. Some of us don't even have a conception of a God who is far better. You know what I'm saying? Like some of us, we've just not been taught well, or maybe we're just new to this Jesus thing, but we've not considered, or we've not seen maybe through the scriptures, or maybe we just weren't told properly that there's a God that is so unbelievably and infinitely beautiful and so majestically glorious and so much joy and goodness and grace is bound up in him that he is far better than anything that the world has. We've not been told that. We've not seen that. We've not experienced that at all. So we have no concept of a God who's far better. I count it as everything is law. What are we even talking about here? Somebody's just like, what does this even mean? Isn't God, if there is one, because some of us aren't even sure of that, but isn't God, if there is one, just, you know, he created everything and he has some control over what he's created and he's got some rules for us and we're to do more good things than bad things and if we do enough, maybe we'll get to heaven and things will be a little bit better. I mean, isn't that what God is? And so for some of us, that's all we know and we don't have this concept that Jesus is of supreme value, that Jesus is to be our highest treasure, that what it means to be a Christian is not that you go to heaven, but that you get Jesus. I promise you, Jesus didn't come die on a cross for your sins and rise on the third day just so that you could go to heaven. No, it's so that you could be in right relation with him. That you can be in a relationship with him. That's what's fractured about you. That's what's broken in you. Heaven comes to earth later on, if you keep reading. Some of you stopped reading. No, the win, the goal, the aim, the focus is we get God. And some of you you've never even heard that. So then what do we do? Then what do we do? How can we say to live is Christ and to die is gain? Now there's really two answers to that. One, the Bible is wrong. Okay? Jesus isn't the highest treasure. The aim of Christianity isn't that we get God. The Bible is wrong. Okay? That's one answer. We're a church. It's not going to be the answer. Okay? The other answer is we just don't know Jesus like that yet. That maybe we just haven't seen him like that yet. We just don't know him like that yet. And so what would it look like for us to know him like that, to see him like that? Okay? So then let's talk. In the Bible, there is a knowing and there is a seeing that doesn't really know and can't really see. Okay? There is a person in the Bible that can know but not really know, that can see but can't really see. In fact, it's all over the Bible, this idea. I'll give you some examples. Jesus in Matthew 13:13, he'll say, he's talking about why he speaks in parables, and he'll say, it's because there are some people who seeing do not see. Right? They're seeing, but they don't see. Or Ezekiel 12:2, it talks about people who dwell in the midst of a rebellious house, who have eyes to see but see not, who have ears to hear but hear not. Same thing in Jeremiah 5:21. There are people who have eyes but see not. So this is why Paul will pray in Ephesians 1 that the eyes of our hearts would be enlightened. Right? The eyes of our hearts would be enlightened, that we can see the hope that he's called us to. And so there's a seeing and then there's a seeing, right? Right? There's a knowing about Jesus and then there's an actual knowing about Jesus. There's a spiritual blindness that some of us have in the eyes of our heart that we can't actually see Jesus. We see him, right? We know him. He's good, and you know, he died on the cross for my sins, and you know, that was nice of him, but we don't see him. There's not been a rush in our heart ever. There's not a sense of the experience of the transcendence of God. And we don't really know him. And so we're seeing, but we're not really seeing. We're knowing, but we're not really knowing. And the difference between those two, the difference between seeing that Jesus is good and glorious, that he's enough, and actually really seeing that Jesus is good and glorious and good enough, is the difference between knowing that honey is sweet and tasting honey. That was Jonathan Edwards, the great 17th century theologian and pastor, it was his word picture. That we can know honey is sweet, but then we can taste it and actually know it's sweet. That's a difference, right? That's a difference. I mean, we know it's sweet, and we know God is good, and, you know, yeah, Jesus is great, but then when we've tasted, now we really know. And those of you that have actually tasted, you realize that you never actually knew until you tasted. The same way that when you tasted honey, you realized that what you knew is not what you knew. Now you know that honey is sweet. It's the difference between knowing and actually experiencing, seeing and actually really experience seeing. And it's why David in Psalms 34 will say, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good." It's an invitation to taste the goodness of Jesus, not just know about it. We can't just read about it. We've got to know it. We've got to experience it. Paul will pray later in Ephesians 3 as he prays again for that church. He prays that they would know the love of Jesus that surpasses knowledge. So it's a love that we can't just know. We've got to actually experience that love. We've got to walk in that love. He's praying that you wouldn't just know about the love of Jesus, but you would walk in, you would experience the love of Jesus, the beauty of Jesus, the goodness of Jesus. That's what the Bible's calling us to over and over and over and over and over again. Psalm 63, the psalmist will say, "Oh God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you." Do you hear that? Earnestly I seek you. "My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. So I have looked upon you in your sanctuary, beholding your power and glory, because your steadfast love is better than life." That's coming from a man that's tasted and seen that the Lord is good. He'll go on to say, and "my lips will praise you. My soul will be satisfied as with fat and rich food, and my mouth will praise you with joyful lips." There's a seeing of the goodness and grandeur of God that's just different than knowing about it. Than knowing about it. And until we do, we can't say to live as Christ, to die as gain. Until we've experienced that, until we see it and respond, until we see him and rejoice, until we experience it and lift our hands, we've not actually tasted and seen that the Lord is good. And so we kind of keep playing, you know, the little American Southern Baptist Bible Belt church game, which is, I mean, it's okay, but it's not the maturity that the Bible is calling us to. There's a fullness, right? Jesus promised that in John 10:10. I give you life abundantly. Where is it? It's in that. It's in the freedom and fearlessness and boldness and risk-taking of a life that says, to live is Christ, to die gain. That's where it's found. And to get it, we've got to be able to actually really see. We've got to taste and experience the goodness and beauty of God. Blaise Pascal, he was a brilliant mathematician, philosopher in the 16th century. I don't know what it means, but there's still like theorems and proofs that we use now, right? I have no idea how that works. I don't even know what a theorem is. And But he's great, right? But he was a Christian as well. And there was this one particular night that he experienced Jesus in a profound way. Right? He, just in a new and profound way. It was just an experience. He tasted. And so what he did is he wrote it all down. Like, he wrote down what it felt like. He wrote down the experience, and he sewed it into his jacket pocket so he would always have it with him. Right? And so he wrote it down. He explains, like, he writes down what happened that night. Here's what he said. He said, in the year of the Lord, 1654, Monday, November 23rd, from about 10:30 in the evening until 12:30, fire. God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, not of philosophers nor of the scholars, certitude, feeling, joy, peace, forgetfulness of the world and of everything except God, greatness of the soul of man, righteous Father, the world has not known thee, but I know thee. Joy, 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 tears of joy. It's almost babbling. But that's what he experienced. He tasted of Jesus and saw that he was good. Or think about the Christian martyrs over the years. Have you ever read any stories about Christians who were killed because of their faith? Over the centuries, the martyrs have repeatedly said, to live is Christ, to die is gain. I would rather be cut off from all my dreams and all the promises and all the joys and all the pleasures of this life if it means I gain Christ. Like, that's been their mantra, their refrain. I could tell you hundreds of stories. I'll just give you one. John Leaf, okay? John Leaf, him and another guy, they're burned at the stake. And it says this, in 1955, this is what happened. John Leaf, he's being tied to the stake, and he turns to his fellow martyr and says, "Be of good comfort, brother, for we shall have a merry supper with the Lord this night." I mean, that is life, man. That is freeing, bold life. You can't take his joy. To die is gain. To live is Christ, to die is gain. Until we know it, until we've experienced the beauties and glories of Jesus, we can't say that. We've not been there yet. We've just not matured in that way yet. We're just not there. We need to be honest with that, but we also need to conceive that it's true. We need to know that there's something to see, that we want to see it. We need to pray and ask and crave. And big question, of course, then is how? Like, how do we see it? How do we see God in that way? How do we really know? How do we really know? If we're being honest, we're not there yet. How do we get there, right? How do we see Jesus in a way that's not just seeing Jesus? The answer? Suffering. The answer is suffering. It's not another Bible study. It's not more church. The answer is suffering. Sin is like lenses that have been put on our eyes. And we see the world through these lenses of sin. And so there's this kind of kaleidoscope of false comforts and false pleasures and false control. And we just kind of view the world through that. We partake in the world through that. And our life kind of centers and revolves around this kind of kaleidoscope of just marred ways in which we view the world. Suffering pulls the lenses off. Suffering takes away the false comforts and the false pleasures and the false controls. It takes it away. And it's not that sin always causes your suffering. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that sin, it's that brokenness of the world. It's that rebellion of God that we now view the world in just a different way. But then suffering, it begins to pull those lenses away. And we begin to see clearly, begin to see more that Jesus is who Jesus is, and the beauties and glories and goodness of Jesus. It begins to remove those lenses. And so as we suffer and as we get tired of doing what we always do in suffering, right? Because most of this isn't the suffering, it's how we respond to suffering. That's what reveals in us what we truly love and what we truly center our life around. How do we respond to the suffering? But as we do, and as we kind of get tired of trying to truck our way through it like we talked about last week, as we get tired of, trying to figure it out, as we get tired of trying to just nail this life through the pain, or just kind of grin and bear through the pain, when we get tired of that, when we get tired of throwing our whole lives into our families or our work or our performance or whatever it is, like when we get tired of that, right, when we find out that that actually doesn't help comfort us, and when we get tired of laying down our body and giving it away to that boy, to that girl, or to that computer screen for comfort, when we get tired of that, when we get tired of everything else, like all the substances we could take, the alcohol, the drugs, the food, the shopping, like we get rid of all of that, like we've experienced all of that that hasn't done anything, and we finally get to the end of ourselves, and we go to Jesus. And we go to Jesus in the midst of our sorrow and suffering, empty-handed with nothing. Broken-hearted, shattered. Diseased body, maybe, perhaps. And we go to him in our suffering, and we see that he's enough. And we see that he's still good. And we see that our joy has not been lost. Now we're beginning to see Jesus in the way that we should see him. Now we're beginning to taste and see that the Lord is good in the way that we need to, in the way that we were meant to. Now we're beginning to understand what it means. We're beginning to realize that to live is Christ and to die is gain. We're beginning to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge. We're beginning to see Jesus in the way that we're meant to see him. You don't know that Jesus is all you really need until Jesus is all you have. You don't know that Jesus is all you really need until Jesus is all you have. And in suffering, that's what happens. And so most of us aren't there yet. I don't know that I'm there yet. The way I respond to suffering still, it shows me that I'm not there yet. But he's going to grow us in that. He's going to mature us in that. And far more than your marriage being awesome and you being healthy and you being wealthy, far more than that, it'll be through suffering and sadness and sorrow that he does that in you. And so to live is Christ and to die is gain. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Let me pray for us. Father, thank you for the hard truth of this, the freeing truth of this. Help us. God, I pray that those of us who are suffering, we would be comforted. I pray that the Paradox Church would be the most compassionate church. Not one that wields deep truths about God as a mallet, a hammer, but that wields deep truths about God as a blanket to the soul.